Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Software Crafts podcast. Today with us we have Matthias Veraz. He's the founder and consultant at Hardlink. He's also the organizing of Domain-Driven Design Europe conference. Hi Matthias, and thanks to be with us in the podcast.
Hi João, thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks. So, let's jump at it. Today it's a bit different. I will not start challenging with an heuristic, our guest, but I will give a topic because this guest is also very into heuristics. And today the topic around it is loss aversion heuristics. So can you tell us a bit more about loss aversion heuristics?
Yeah. So, how would you actually describe loss aversion?
Well, good question. For me, and let's start with my own vision, is if I'm really emotional attached to something. So it's more than the face value, but my emotional attachment to it. If it is my baby sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think in psychology, so Kahneman and Tversky did a lot of research, and they have been mostly focusing on framing it as economic loss. So I think it's because it's easier to measure, probably, right? So they did a whole bunch of surveys and experiments where they, for example, ask you, would you pick, 100% certain win of €1,000? Or would you pick a 90% win of €2,000 with a 10% chance of losing €200 or something? And I don't know the exact numbers, but they did a whole bunch of this stuff, and it turns out that people are putting a lot more weight to a potential loss than to an equal potential gain. Right, that's sort of it's very often monetary in their experiments, probably other things as well, but it's sort of economic loss, right? I think what you're describing is sort of what I think as well, that it's more than that. There's an emotional loss, right? I'm not a psychologist, right? So everything from now on is anecdotal, my own experience. But it's fascinating that you have this same sort of feeling, right? That there's an emotional attachment to something. So I think that we are very much afraid of losing things in a very implicit way, right? We don't really, we're not really aware that, oh, but I might lose something. And it's all kinds of things, right? Maybe work you've already done, well, that's still economic loss, right? But maybe just an idea you had and you'd have to give up on that idea, or an opinion you already have, right? Or maybe you made a plan, right? And maybe the making that plan was not a lot of work, but you have some kind of emotional investment in it, right? So the first of these three heuristics that I use is that I call it a loss aversion, right? It's to remind yourself to be averse to this loss aversion that you have, right? So it could be anything, right? It could be just something that is comfortable, right? You might lose some comfort because doing something new out of your comfort zone is higher energy, right? It feels more risky. And so the heuristic is about reminding yourself to identify where you might lose something. I think that loss aversion in itself, it's a bias, right? It's a psychological bias that we have. I don't think it's a particularly irrational one, right? I think there's a very good reason that we have this, because losing stuff is a risk, right? It used to be, of course, that if you lost something important, you couldn't even survive, probably back in the cave in prehistoric times. So I think in that sense, it's a very, very much grounded in actual survival mechanics. But of course, we are far beyond that stage. Your life is not at risk if your plan has to change. But I think we feel that same sort of visceral reaction to it. So we need to be very aware of it. We need to think about how it affects us. So to relate this to software, right? If you have some software design that you made, some clever solution, maybe you spend some time domain modeling, you're going to feel attachment to these ideas, right? You're going to, anybody that comes with a different idea, you're going to perceive that as a threat, right? Maybe a threat to your ego, but a threat to losing something, right? So you need to try to find that in yourself and at every sort of potential decision point, or when you get new information, or when somebody comes with a different idea or approach, ask yourself, right? What am I going to lose here if this happens? And then, of course, you need to compare that to what you might win from it, right? Maybe this new idea would actually work better. It's not about what I personally win; it's what the company or the group or the organization wins.
And this, sorry to interrupt you. I know that you have more, but this is a very interesting point, right? Because both of us are in the industry of software. Yeah. And one of things, this week I was speaking another podcast, and I was talking about this interesting property of the software, that is changeability. It's very easy to change software in production, which is different from manufacturing, right? The headphones that we are using, they are in production. It's very hard to change them, right? We're going to break all of these. And at the same time, last time that I was on Domain-Driven Design Europe conference in person, Kent Beck said a thing in the keynote that is, every time that the software goes to production, changes itself, right? Because people start using and finding new uses to the software. And now you are talking about our attachment that we have an idea and we do in software. But if we also use Kent Beck work, once it gets to production, changes it. How can we be aware and tame our bias? Because I think that is related to what you were saying before I interrupt you.
Yeah, no, but it's that, right? I think everything is under constant change. This is, the changeability of software is on the one hand one of the great things about it. At the same time, it's sort of the cause of massive complexity. We can, with software, because there's no physical or not many physical constraints, it can acquire complexity much faster than any other sort of engineering we've done in history. And then of course that creates faster competition, etc. So you're going to be under constant stress of change in software environments. So if you're then attached to old ideas, you're your worst enemy. Right, a lot, and it's not just software, right? It's all your decision making. We are often our own worst enemy because we get stuck in some idea. And there's other stuff in here, right? There's Kahneman describes coherence bias. At least I think it was him, where if you have some information or some mental model in your head, you're more likely, when you're presented with new information, you're likely to try to actually fit that into that same bucket. So new information is fitted into your existing mental model, as opposed to updating your mental model. Updating your mental model is system two. It's high energy, right? And so if we can do the cheap thing of fitting the new information into our old model, it's low energy, and our brain rewards us for that, right? You get this feeling of, oh, I get it, right? It's just like this other thing. That's another heuristic, but it's related here, right? The moment you feel you have this experience, like, oh, now I get it. It's just like this other thing. What you're probably doing is fitting into a model as opposed to understanding or acquiring a new model, right? And I think it's related, right? That this loss aversion of that old model is somewhere a deep emotional attachment there as well.
It's very interesting, right? I usually, within my work, so we work on same fields, I must say. You talk about this heuristic that, looks like it's very similar, or it's like the other thing. I usually had conversations where people goes, oh, this is just semantics. And this is where my breaking point. Okay, let's talk about semantics. What do you mean by that? Because usually is when people are exactly doing what you describe, pick this information, put in their current mental model, and let's move on, rather than, oh, here is a weak signal that we need now to invest time to figure out, do we generate a new model, or are we looking to the same thing from different angles, can be, or anything else? It's very, very interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, software is, you know, it's bits in some you know, processors, and everything else is semantics, right? The computer doesn't care about semantics, that's true, but you know, the art of software is describing a solution in a way that you can still understand and modify it. That's where all the money goes. It's not in making a machine do things. That's easy.
Well described way back.
Yeah.
In your work, when do you have these moments? What do you do? So let me put some context and constraints to you. Let's play this game. Let's say that you are having a conversation with teams about these how they model, and you find this moment where they say, oh, this looks like this other thing. At that point, what is your go-to behavior or technique or practice to deepen conversation?
Well, I want to first frame the second heuristic, because the first one, loss aversion, is sort of personal, right? Be very aware. You need to do that first. You need to learn that first, to look into your own, you know, implicit thinking process, identify potential loss, consider if it's actually a loss worth taking. But then the next one, I'm not sure if it's a good name for it, but I call it distributed loss aversion. It's everybody else is also afraid of losing something, right? That's the heuristic, right? It's consider it, find it, make it explicit, deal with it, do proper trade-offs. So instead of waiting until people have this experience, oh, it's just like this other thing we did, or we already have it, or it's just the same thing with a different name. Well, maybe it's not, right? But I try to beat it, because it's harder to get to convince people to get rid of that feeling than it is to sort of catch it before it happens, if that makes sense, right? So this second heuristic, distributed loss aversion, is assume that everybody else has loss aversion. Try to find very early on what they're afraid of. Right. Very often in my work, I'm usually working either with teams or with leadership teams. I'm sort of on the edge of doing, you know, domain modeling and software design, and then sort of also looking at the strategy, design strategy, where we need to look at everything that impacts design. Right, you can have the best possible design ideas, but if there's no environment where you can actually find them and apply them, etc., then it doesn't work. So, you know, we might look at team organization or business strategy and vision and product, and, you know, anything that matters, politics even. So I map all these things, right? I put these on big maps. You know, it could be money flows, it could be, you know, sponsorship, it could be you know, decision making control and ownership and these kind of things. Just anything. I put that on these maps, and I annotate it with, you know, what constraints do we have here, which could be, you know, internal constraints or regulation or physical constraints or anything. I try to put those on the map, right? We're not allowed to do that for contractual reasons, or customers are used to this now, so we can't change it. That sort of stuff I put on the map as well. I look for assumptions, right? In fact, a lot of these constraints turn out to be assumptions. Right, we can't do this, or customers would never want this. And then you go check with the customers, and, you know, they've been asking for this for years. My best example there is that I was doing a session with one of the founders who was the CTO. I said, yeah, we should solve this. You know, this is some technical problem, and we should solve this. But my co-founder will never go for this and want to spend the money. And then I have a session with the CEO. And he says, yeah, and why can't my CTO understand that they need to solve this first? I want to pay for this. I want to make this. So, of course, this is a simple example. But if you do this sort of mapping, you see all these, like putting lots of different stuff on the same map. So you see clusters of constraints and assumptions and bottlenecks. And that's where I started looking as well, right? Why is this constraint? Is this a perceived constraint, right? Are we actually afraid of losing something? So I assume that people are afraid of losing something. Maybe I should call it assumed loss aversion. That might be a good name for it. And I tried to find it. And I don't have like, that's still a gap, I think. I don't have like a very good approach where I can easily expose that, because in some situations, if you ask, what are you afraid of losing? Right? That's a very direct, hard question. And maybe it depends on culture as well. The Dutch have a much more sort of open debate culture than, say, you know, if you go more east, it's much, much different.
Definitely.
Go ahead.
I think so, right? So it's, you are raising a thought that I debate with myself, right? That is reading weak signals. They are there in the particular system, right? We as consultants, we jump in, and one of our qualities is reading these weak signals. This is what I think that defines a consultant, right? You need to go quickly in. You need to define something and get out. If not, you become part of that system. You cannot call yourself a consultant, right? It's a full-time employee of that company. How can we raise these without confront people, right?
Yeah. And somebody told me something. I haven't tried it yet, so I can't really explain it very well as well. But I think the idea was to sort of start with very simple things, right? Like making some fears explicit, setting the example, and allowing that to become sort of part of the conversation. So it could be maybe something as simple as, I'm afraid we'll get interrupted again because there was a production issue, right? That's a very normal fear to discuss openly, right? That's not very confrontational in the sense that, what are you afraid of is, right? So maybe that's the better approach, right? To try to create an environment over time where, it's okay and accepted and encouraged to make these fears explicit. That's probably where we need to start looking for this. But also, I don't want to just sort of, you know, because we're consultants that we have to do this in a short time and we need very optimal strategies to do that. I think we also need to think about how would you do this if you're somewhere in a long-term engagement or employment and trying to do better, right? And identifying that. That's probably a bigger discussion, but I think it's important to, you know, this relationship, right? The loss aversion in yourself, personal loss aversion, distributed or social, I don't know what to call it, or assumed loss aversion in others. I think that's the, you know, that's the path. And then I have a third heuristic, and I call it presupposed loss aversion. And that's the very, that's a trickier one. The way it works is, everybody thinks that everybody else is afraid of losing something. So, but very implicitly, right? It's not that they say, oh, but the manager or the CEO will be afraid of losing, you know, this but it is so deeply embedded in our psyche that if there is a chance of something causing loss for somebody, we will not even consider that option. We will not even propose it, right? Let's say, I don't know, just some random idea that comes to mind. We should switch to this new technology. Yeah, but this person has says that he doesn't want to work on that technology. If he has to stop doing what he's doing and move to this other technology, he will quit and go to another company. that's a loss. Therefore, we don't consider it, right? That would be a very, that's dangerous if we're not, maybe it is the right idea, right? Maybe we should keep this person, I don't know. But if we're not even considering it, we're not making proper trade-offs, right? We're dismissing good ideas simply because we perceive that they might have a potential loss for somebody else who might care about it, right? So maybe we think the CEO will not want us to make a decision that would cause us to lose this person. Whereas the gain is maybe much greater. Maybe there's a huge community of people who could actually do a really good job, that a pool that we could hire from, and I don't know, right? But and same for all kinds of much less like this is a very clear loss, right? It's losing a person in favor of maybe gaining others and gaining a new technology. That's maybe an obvious trade-off. But
and in my head, I have the feeling that this heuristic is also is a roadblock for really interesting discussions.
Yes.
But in your example, it's a very, very interesting discussion, right? It's about trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
But if people have these and take an option out of the table, well, we lose an opportunity to have a discussion about that option, deep discussion, right? Rather than a superficial one, which can be dangerous for a company, right? Not discussing the right things. Maybe hard things, but the right things.
Yeah. Yeah, it happens all the time, I think. I have a story from my own experience here. We had the Europe conference. It was always an in-person conference. The pandemic hit, and this conference has always had a major focus on interaction and collaboration. So we had normal talks, 50-minute talks, but we had a lot of focus on what we call hands-on labs. You know, where people are in small groups, maybe with an instructor, could be exercises, could be practicing something, doing modeling, messing with post-its and drawing on whiteboards and discussions and all this sort of stuff. And I think this helped create sort of an environment where people actually come to this conference not to watch talks. The talks are important, right? They are like the conversation starters, but a lot of the real experience is what happens, you know, in we have long breaks, we have whiteboards all over the venues. So people are given a lot of opportunity to, in a sort of safe environment, to play with these ideas that maybe they don't get the opportunity at their job, or they're too unfamiliar with it to even try it. So like event storming is a modeling technique. Maybe just having the opportunity to play around with this for 2 hours in this environment can trigger a lot of stuff that a presentation alone would not give you. And then of course we have the pandemic, and we have to decide to do, you know, do, are we going to do an online conference or not do anything? Or, and of course how did I apply this? Like, what am I afraid of losing? Well, I'm afraid that if we don't do anything, you know, we will lose our audience, and this thing will, we don't know how long it will last, this pandemic, et cetera, right? So that was a real and a rational loss, right? It's a great thing, this conference, and losing it would be a sad thing. But then what else am I afraid of losing? And so I was very much sort of, you know, hesitant about doing an online conference because I was afraid of losing this very interactive experience. And we have this format, right, where it's a whole bunch of talks and then these labs, etc. And so I was trying to understand, like, another thing I was afraid of losing. It took me a while to figure this all out, right? But that we have sort of, you know, grown our audience and trained our audience to expect this sort of very interactive conference. So people who maybe are only interested in just coming to see talks, they would, you know, they can do that. They can just come to the conference and watch talks. But I was afraid that I would lose the mindset in our sort of community of this interactive thing, that people would perceive the conference as just a regular series of talks, right? And then of course I was also, like everybody, afraid that, you know, or we will lose money on this, all the sort of normal things. And then I started sort of figuring out, okay, what am I afraid of losing? What can I afford to lose? What don't I want to lose? At some point I told myself, okay, if we break even, that's good enough, right? Or maybe even take a small loss and consider it maybe like a marketing cost. And that immediately opens, like you're not trying to scale anymore. You don't have to have the same number of take, well, and our prices were lower because it was online and we didn't know if people would want to do it. So, you know, we could try things that would have, you know, if they have a small financial loss, it would be okay. So the range of options increases. And then I said, what else, you know, what do I really want? I want this interactive stuff. How can we do this online? And at some point, I realized that, well, what if we keep only the interactive stuff, right? So what we did is we got rid of, we didn't have any presentations, or some short, like some lightning talks, 10 minute things, but the whole conference was hands-on labs online and, you know, using Zoom and Miro and breakout, not Zoom, but Hopin, but breakout rooms and all that stuff. And everything was interactive. So we had lost a whole bunch of stuff, but we had kept something that we felt was the core, you know, the heart of the conference, right? It's hard to sort of describe the whole process, right? Because this took many months of thinking, and we actually set up some experiments and did smaller versions of this and to test this. So it was a well reasoned about trade off. It was still sort of, you know, painful going through this process of deciding everything we could potentially lose there. But I feel it was worth it. People told us that it was you know, the best online conference they've attended that year. So that that makes me very happy. Somebody said it's the conference I didn't know I needed. So, but yeah, it's not easy, right? Having these heuristics makes the decision process more painful, and especially if you have to involve others who, you know, at least here I had the benefit of being the one who got to decide this, whether my colleagues liked it or not. But that's not always the case, right? You need to convince others to take that loss.
And first of all, thanks for sharing this story, because well, it's very personal to you, and well, the listeners are not seeing this, but I see lots of emotion in your face. And I know how well domain-driven design Europe, it's your baby, right? So start, yes, very small, absolutely. And then grew. Actually, right, was the we were in Amsterdam just before the lockdown on 2020. It was just before.
Yeah,
and I also had the opportunity to experiment on 2021, the Europe, and well, my experience fits, right? Was quite well organized, really focused on interactions. Different interactions that we didn't have in the past, but well, the world changed. And I also must add, on top of that, you are not only decided for the conference, right? But all your life around you change. Because during a while, you had, right, family at home and school from home. Yeah. All your interactions with your customers change, which also open a range of opportunities. You don't need to travel across the world, right? You can just... So in a short amount of time, everything around us changes, right? And yet here we are, right? We have some resilience capacity, which leads to my next question. What did you discover in yourself in terms of resilience? What did you learn with all this pandemic process and your way of working, family, conference, all of these?
Yeah. Wow, that's a good question. I maybe because you mentioned this, all this, right? I think in terms of resilience, like it's still a simple example, right? We used to do almost everything in person with our clients. And there's a lot of things you can't do, like read online, like read body language. If I'm, you know, doing modeling with groups of people and I look at how they're physically reacting, and that tells me something. We lost that. We couldn't, you know, move physical post-its. We couldn't move across a room and join random conversations. And I was very much feeling this loss. And then, you know, partly thanks to my colleagues who have been sort of pushing for, I was sort of like very resistant to this online stuff. I have great colleagues who were pushing for, no, we need to like rethink it. And then we actually did that, right? And instead of saying, how can we rescue or imitate in a weaker version online what we did in person, we changed the question to, what is the actual value we're trying to achieve? And what new ways, what interaction patterns, et cetera, can we come up with that give us some of that value and that creates opportunity for discovering new value? So, one thing that was maybe that's for you know, your question about resilience, right? The best insight I got very early on that helped me was I was in a workshop with Dave Snowden, and he talks about acceptation. And the way he explains it is most innovation doesn't happen, you know, in the way we think, where a genius has a brilliant insight, eureka moment, and something out of thin air appears. But he says, everything that you can find in a hotel room that you could use as a bottle opener, I have used it as a bottle opener, because he couldn't find a bottle opener. So what he's saying is most innovation happens in emergencies, where you're using something for a purpose it was not designed for or wasn't made for, and you use it in some novel way to solve a problem, and then you iterate on it. If, you know, I don't know, a clothes hanger, you open a bottle with it, hey, this is actually an interesting way of opening a bottle, and then you evolve that clothes hanger into a completely new kind of bottle opener. That's how most innovation works. So I think that, you know, we can open ourselves up to becoming more resilient by understanding how we evolve, how we innovate, how we adapt, how acceptation works. That's probably where, like, it's a hard question to answer. I'd have to think about it. But I think also that just in general, people are very resilient. And I think one of the hardest bottlenecks in the whole pandemic is that people were sort of, the phrase going back to normal, right? That's the wrong idea, right? People, loss aversion, right? People were afraid, if we're closing schools, students will get behind, right? So students will lose something that they should have gotten, and that will have negative impact in the long run. That's the mindset, right? That's pure loss aversion. Whereas the answer should be, well, first of all, everybody is losing this. All students are losing, you know, 3 weeks during lockdown or something. That they're equal, right? They haven't lost something relative to each other. That could be one start of looking at it. The second is, why are we even doing in-person stuff anyway? Because historically, that was the only way to do it, of course. So whenever people were trying to get back to normal, what they should have done is, how can we adapt? How can we use? We are, in a sense, historically, we are in the worst possible time for a pandemic, in the sense that there's anti-vax and all this, you know, misinformation and all that. But we're also in the best time because we have all the technology to do a lot of these things. We just haven't accepted it yet to things like education, or not enough. So the gain of doing a lockdown, besides health, of course, public health, would be the you know, never waste a crisis, right? Use this crisis to come up with new ways, and then maybe in the future we would find new acceptations where we're doing, you know, in-person education again, but it's somehow enriched with other stuff, right? Maybe we can have guest lectures, we can have remote, right? We can have, well, that's an obvious thing, but I mean, even in that's a normal thing in like university, but not in children education, which is very much one teacher and maybe a gym teacher and you know, something like that. Who knows, they could interact with people from across the country. All these sort of things that we could have sown the seeds for that now, where in 10 years we have completely novel ways of education that are maybe much better. I don't know, but it's the the small potential loss, which is relatively not even a loss. And that, you know, there's ways to catch up with that, right? Should be traded off against the real, you know, gain of public health. And the potential gain, the options, the optionality of future gains that we might not even predict, if that makes sense.
It makes, right? Because I also heard that a lot, right? Even in the company that I work, oh, if we go back, because we have a culture, an in-person culture, and our knowledge session, internal mini conferences every 2 weeks, and everyone was, oh, we lost these, and now what are we going to do? Well, it's a matter of time. Just let people do it. Put the constraint that we need to continue to do it. However, the format, who cares, right? So needs to go on because it's a principle of the company that allows knowledge to emerge and new connections. But the format, who cares, right? And I think that now this worked quite well, and this is a company, and now I'm observing that, especially now, right? Everyone was, well, end of 2021, we'll be okay. We have vaccines and then we'll be okay. And now we are seeing 2022, right? The skyrocketing everywhere in the world, that people finally are going, oh, we might need to change. We might need to think in the next 10 years, which especially on the politician class, I never heard these. And now I start reading weak signals again. I read lots of new papers across Europe. I noticed the language changing. Oh, this is not going anywhere. And it's nature. We as humans, we are a blip in the size of the universe. So yes, this is not going away because our lifespan is way shorter than the planet or universe lifespan, right? And regards to education, I was interim CTO in a company, and I see that company, although was targeting enterprises, there was a wish to go towards traditional education and also bring the concepts, the asynchronous, the outcome focus rather than output focus towards our traditional or mandatory, at least here in Europe, mandatory education. So I think that is a matter of time, right? The thing is that we come from software where we measure things in nanoseconds and milliseconds, right? We do a test and we get feedback, hopefully quickly. Some test suites take hours to run, but this is a different engineering discussion. But now we are talking about problems that take a bit longer to get the feedback, right?
Yeah, they're decades long or even a century. Whereas, of course, well, politicians are a great example of loss aversion, right? It's voters. Any decision is, are we going to lose voters on this? That's the big story. And I think part of what loss aversion causes is that we want growth to always go up. Whereas, of course, if you know, sometimes you need to go down first and then go up later. That's, you know, for a lot of interesting problems, you need to, you know, dismantle the system, or you need to you know, take a learning cost or take an innovation or a discovery cost before you can grow again. This is perfectly normal in all kinds of natural systems and human systems, but we're so afraid of it. Like, take careers. How often have you changed jobs to a lower paying job with higher long-term potential, right? People don't do this. It's assumed that you don't change jobs if it's paying less. No matter how terrible your job is and how it may be destroying your life, and, you know, maybe it's so stressful that it takes 10 years of your life, but that's a long-term loss that you can't see, and the money could be a short-term loss that is maybe worth taking just to, you know, if you can change jobs to a different industry or something and you start lower, but this loss buys you the opportunity to learn something new or go into a new space that you actually want to be, or have a more pleasant working environment, or all these things that are not monetary gains that we're not trading off well enough.
Well, you give an example that is close to home, right? Because myself and my wife, we did these when we moved from Ireland here to the Netherlands. We took the financial one because we were not comfortable there. We didn't feel comfortable. Yeah. And we took the financial one. We were a very, really nice jobs. We liked the companies. And that is the strange stuff, but we weren't comfortable with society. And we took that loss. Crossing the canal and coming to the Netherlands where we are, we took that. And, well, interesting things happen. I think that I bloom and move from companies to consultancy and doing this kind of stuff. And my wife is trying her own business, thing that was not envisioned a few years back. So
nice.
It is very interesting, right? We jump. Of course, it's first world. Yes, the salary went down, but... Well, of course. Relative to other things, it's very high salary. But in relative terms, my own experience was a very interesting one. Took us 1 year of several iterations what we were doing until we were so uncomfortable that we were, okay, this is the moment. Let's do it.
Yeah. And so do you feel it was like an emergency forcing your decision, or was it a very sort of conscious process of identifying your potential loss?
I will not say an emergency. We start noticing signals, you know, because we were socially active and like to we were in Dublin, see the city and travel. And then we noticed that we were avoiding. But why are we avoiding? You know, the homeless rate when we left Ireland was higher. We left Ireland 4 years ago, so 2017. Yes, almost 5 years ago, 2017. And they had more homeless people than in the peak of financial crisis in 2012. And we moved to Ireland in 2013. So we were thinking, why are we doing this? Okay, some symptoms are here, but what is really deep down there, right? And we start to reason that. And then is when the economical part came up, that in the beginning we said, okay, but if we move, we cannot lose these, blah, 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 until... maybe the emergency came up and we said, okay, we are not happy, right? We are not happy. And if we are not happy, what is the point, right? Then it's just because of the money. Then we become greedy. What's the point, right? And that is when the decision was, okay, let's do it.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I think it's everywhere. And The awareness, like this is not the problem, but Kahneman's book Thinking Fast and Slow describes all these biases, and it can make you very sort of depressed, right? We are not as smart as we think. We are very irrational. We have all this stuff influence. Even like there's a bunch of this stuff where they show that even if you are aware of the bias, you still are susceptible to it. Like the anchoring, right? If even if you know that a car salesman will present you with the cheapest, the middle, and the most expensive option, so that this expensive option anchors you to the high price, so that the medium price seems reasonable to you. Even if you're aware of this effect, you can still be influenced by it. It's very depressing when you learn about stuff. But I'm now reading, I haven't finished it yet, but it's called The Scout Mindset by Julia Galef. And she's very much trying to sort of be the answer to how do you then actually, make better decisions and think better despite your biases. So she's sort of trying to turn it into the upside of it. She opens the book with, it might be depressing, but the good news is there's room for improvement. We can actually get a lot better than we are now. So her model is the soldier mindset is you're defending your opinions and your beliefs, etc. And everything that contradicts it is an attack where you have to, you will lose something, right? If you have to change your mind, whereas the scout mindset is much more, seeking actual truth and being aware of these biases, etc. And then I think later in the book, she's going to offer a bunch of like practical ways to do it. But in the opening, she says, in the soldier mindset, when you're confronted with new information, you will ask yourself if that information confirms your belief. You're asking yourself, can I believe this, right? And you look for this confirmation. If it contradicts your beliefs, you're asking, must I believe this, right? What can I find in this thing that discredits it? And you're going to, it feels like you're doing rational work, but you're going to look at maybe, oh, but this author is an idiot, or, you know, or what is the source, or you're going to find anything, any flaw in it, to use it as an argument not to adopt the new belief. And in the scout mindset, you're not asking that, you're asking, is it true? That's the question, right? Well, what can I find? Is it true or not? Whether I believe it or not, is it true? So the proper sort of, you know, scientific mindset as well. So I'm very excited to finish the book and actually know what the rest of it is. But
yeah, very cool. And to round up, right, we are near the end of the episode. You already start putting some resources on the table, let's say like yeah. that. But let me ask a formal question. What are the resources that you recommend to our listeners, to our audience?
Yeah, so that, the scout mindset, thinking fast and slow, is well known, of course. I haven't written about this loss aversion heuristics. I should probably do that. But I wrote about the one that I mentioned. I call it the It's Just Like heuristic. So I have a blog post on that. This idea that when you are confronted with something and you feel you understand it, that might be the sign that you don't. That's your brain rewarding you for putting it in a bucket. I think those are there's some other stuff on my blog as well. Maybe that would be relevant. And I'm sure there's a blog that I used to read, but it's been a while, called You're Not So Smart. It's at yournotsosmart.com, and I saw now that they have a book as well. That's probably worth it's sort of more of a, I think, more of a you know, more popularized version of ideas in Kahneman and Tversky.
All right, thanks. I will make sure that these resources are on description of the episode. Also, your social media links, so the listeners can go directly to you, not to me. So the discussion can start at the proper level. And once again, I want to thank for your time. This was a very fun recording for me.
Well, me too. Thanks for having me. And I like your podcast. It's very good. So,
thanks. Thanks. You can follow us on Twitter at @scraftspodcast. Follow our page on LinkedIn or visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com. Hope to have with us next week.